From WGCU, this is the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. I'm Carrie Barber. Today on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club, we talk with Aaron Summers, author of the new novel, The 10-Year Affair. In this innovative book, new mother Cora meets Sam in a baby group. Each is married to someone else, but the sexual attraction between them is undeniable. The story splits into parallel timelines, one where they have an affair and one where they don't. New York Magazine recently named the novel one of the best new books you should read in October, and I found it impossible to put down. I'm thrilled to have the chance to talk with author Aaron Summers today on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. Welcome, Aaron.
Hi, happy to be here.
I read that this book started as a short story and that it was kind of a riff on the Cheever and Updike infidelity stories. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yes. Well, it began as a very short story, only around 13 pages. But after that was published, I didn't feel done with the world of it. I was pretty taken with the narrator, this woman, Cora, and I wanted to continue to expand her world and build it out a lot more and figure out what she did for a living and what the rest of her life looked like. And so it grew into a much longer project.
And also, these characters are millennials, which make them so different in so many ways from the Cheever and Updike characters. So let's get into that a little bit. How are they different, and what were some of the differences that you had to consider from those? I just picture like the gray suit man on the Metro North going to work. What's different about these characters?
Absolutely. So I love all those books, the Rabbit Runs and the Revolutionary Roads and the Cheever short stories. I sort of came up reading those books and read a lot of them, you know, in my education. And I thought that it was time for an update, though, that those stories didn't necessarily speak to people's lives so much anymore, or that they resonated still in certain ways in certain areas. But there are new and evolving attitudes around marriage, around child rearing. And I thought it would be exciting and really fun to update that type of narrative with some of the, with just like the way we live now and the way people who are just reaching adulthood or people who are in young middle age are living, and play with the ways that life is different now from when those books were written and how it's much the same too.
Yes. Oh, it's so interesting. I mean, for one thing, what I remember of those books is usually it was only the man was working and the woman often stayed at home raising the kids. And that kind of plays into the economic considerations, which the millennial characters in this book have a lot of economic weight on their shoulders, which I think is so different from those characters in the 1950s and 60s. Can you talk a bit about that? Like, what were the economic considerations you took into consideration for these characters?
Yeah, I mean, I think you cut right to the crux of it, that the book is about an affair and it is about this really juicy interpersonal thing, but is also slyly just looking at the material conditions of middle-class life. And what does it take these days to be middle class? What does it look like to be middle class? And whereas in the mid-century, being middle class was attainable. That was a dream within everyone's reach. And you could live pretty prosperously and take your family on vacation and have two cars and whatever. And that has shifted a lot, so that people finding themselves in this part of life now, you can't really have the same sort of stability. And you're sort of holding on to the bottom rung of the middle class. Both parents have to work. Both parents have to parent and manage the kids flat out as hard as they can. So it's just a much more tenuous and challenging environment.
Yeah, that's well said. And it's also, as you said, it's also a book about infidelity, obviously, and about marriage. So in addition to the economic considerations, what made you interested in writing about marriage just as a topic, and in these two marriages in particular?
I've been interested in marriage and child rearing probably because I spent the last 10 years married and raising small children. So, and that's where my friends were at too. And what I saw, in my own marriage and in the marriages of my peers is really this marriage between friends, where the reason people enter marriages these days, one of the reasons, is just out of camaraderie and friendship and love, right? Like, it's not as much about exchange of property anymore. Women are much more free to choose. So it's really about picking someone you want to hang out with. And I really wanted to dig into, what does that mean in terms of how that obligates you to the other person? What holds you there in a marriage between friends? Yeah, so that's sort of what that question motivated a lot of the book.
Your book is so full of really funny and sharp observations, and I feel like that was a particular one that hit me, that the men kind of know what to say, but they're still not really helping that much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we've come so far, right? Men are definitely pitching in. They're picking up much more of the domestic slack. I think we saw, for instance, a big shift in the pandemic where men sort of realized that, or were perhaps just more present and available to help out with domestic work and care work. And so there was sort of a great leap forward where men are much more involved. That said, it's still very much a work in progress, meaning it doesn't function perfectly yet. It's still not perfectly equitable. So while everyone knows where we're headed and what we're trying to aim for, and probably in many cases, both parties earnestly want that, we haven't quite achieved it yet. And so that causes a lot of friction in a lot of households, I think, is that the men know what they're supposed to be doing, and it's just not quite being executed yet.
The novel really investigated, I mean, beyond just domestic labor, it really investigated gender roles in marriage. Like Sam's wife, Jules, is really invested in her career, and she's like a little bit prickly. You know, she's maybe a little too invested in her career for a woman. You know, she struck me as kind of like, if she were a male character, everything she did would be perfectly fine. But can you talk about that a little bit, just the gender roles in general?
Sure. Well, in thinking about this book, I thought a lot about sort of the women I know, and especially the high achieving women I know, and the women I know who have very successful and impressive careers, and kind of the way that we were raised by our very cool boomer mothers to focus on education, to try really hard, to sort of stop at nothing to pursue exactly the career we wanted to and live the way we wanted to. And I don't know that there was that same emphasis for boys at the time. So in my generation, we're seeing really big gains in that department where women have great careers. You know, they're dominating in lots of fields and they're really living the lives they want, which is totally amazing. And on the other hand, I think that some of the men are a little bit lost, because if the women are making most of the money and still also, in spite of everyone's best intentions, doing most of the domestic work and care work, it's a bit like, what are the roles of men? Where do the men fit in? And where do they find their purpose? But I wanted to approach that not as a problem that's anybody's fault, but just as a situation everyone is earnestly trying to navigate and do the right thing for their families. So the men in the book are not villains in any way. They are just, you know, people trying to figure out how they fit in.
This was a bracing line for me, where Cora meets an older woman on vacation and she says, quote, "If you agree to share your life with someone, you're never free again." No one is allowed to say it, but it's true. I have been married for a long time, too, and I just read that and went, because it feels very true to me. Can you tell me about that line and how you got to that?
I think just in marriage, if it's a real partnership and a real marriage of love, you can't ever fully extricate. Even if you left the marriage, I think it's always with you. That person is always going to be with you, someone that you share your life with fully and you're completely, you know, intertwined with, intermeshed with. When I think about my husband, I think that every part of my life touches every part of his life. We could never, the metaphor I've used before in a different short story is when kids jam all the different colors of Play-Doh together and then they hand you the ball of Play-Doh and say, like, separate it back out again. You know, they want the yellow back unattached from the red. And it's like, it doesn't really work that way. It's all mashed together. And that's sort of the way I feel about us, especially a long marriage, is it's like, it's, you're all mashed together. You're not ever going to get out cleanly again.
And everything has to be a negotiation. I mean, you can't, unless it's a marriage where one person is just getting none of their needs met, it's always going to be a discussion. It's always going to be a collaboration. So it's never again that thing when you're single and you're like, I'm going to go have a hamburger for dinner. Like, it's just never going to be like that again.
Totally. It's, you're obligated to someone suddenly, you know, you, even in, of course, in a marriage, in a healthy marriage, you give each other a lot of independence, but you still are obligated to check in with your spouse, know what each other are doing, you know, sign off in a general way on various behaviors. And, you know, you opt into that obligation and it can be really lovely and really gratifying to share your life with someone, but you are never unfettered again.
So did writing this book give you any more insight into marriage, or was it more like a place for you to put what you had learned about marriage?
I mean, I guess I talked myself into being way more patient just by writing these characters in a very empathetic way from all different angles of marriage and all different situations, you know, that I haven't even engaged with in my own life. I just sort of convinced myself of the need for patience and empathy and humor, which is something I already knew, but it sort of reinforced it. Outside of that, I don't know that I wouldn't claim to have any wisdom about it, except just that I think that people do their best generally. People try their best and people are flawed. So it's not going to be perfect, but to think about things from the point of view of people are mostly well-meaning.
And along those lines, I know, you know, parents typically want their kids to have a better life than they did, whether that's financially or educationally or just trying not to make the parenting mistakes that they feel like their own parents made. Do you feel like millennial parents have that wish more? Do you think they're more trying not to make the parenting mistakes that their parents made, or they're more willing to defy the type of parenting that they themselves had?
I'll say this about my generation is that we are characterized, you know, it's a huge group of people. So with the caveat that it's very hard to make a generalization about this group of people, we're very self-aware and very conscious of everything, a hyper-aware, hyper-conscious generation who has overthought every angle of everything. So that I think, yes, millennial parents are definitely looking to correct mistakes, break cycles, fix what their parents might have done wrong, even to the point of comedy, you know, or, you know, absurdity, which is where the book derives some of its humor, is millennials just overshooting it by attempting these outlandish parenting techniques that are over the top and there's no real need for them, you know, in this sort of well-meaning attempt to raise their kids correctly.
We were talking before we started recording about how this book is set in the Hudson Valley, which is an area just north of New York City. It's kind of rural and artsy, and a lot of city folk moved there during lockdown. Can you tell me why you chose that setting and what it allowed you to write about?
I moved here in 2017, so I beat the pandemic rush, and I got to observe this huge tidal wave of people up from New York City, and I got to observe all of their mannerisms and, you know, social quirks. And I found them really fascinating. And I thought that this specific place, which is not necessarily rich, just middle class, but has cultural pretensions. You know, there's an art museum. There are art museums around here and big modern art sculpture gardens. And there's, you know, farm to table restaurants and things of that nature. I thought that it made it a great setting to focus on this very narrow segment of the population that has these cultural pretensions, but is not fabulously wealthy. And I thought that mostly it could be very funny, that it could be very funny to send up just, you know, all the social quirks the way these people are, and that it would make a great setting for a comedy of manners.
Yes, you were correct. It did. I just felt like you did a beautiful job with capturing that exact sort of group of people.
Thank you. Yeah, I also don't, you know, there are so many wonderful, hilarious books about class novels about the rich, totally setting up the rich. Mm-hmm. And I thought that what is special about this setting is that it gives you pretentious, but just middle class. And I thought it could be really unique to write a novel of the middle class these days. You know, we already talked about Updike and Cheever and all those guys when writing about the middle class was like a huge topic, right? Mm-hmm. Probably because the middle class was much larger and more people were interested in it. But I just thought it was time to, or it could be time to revive the middle class novel and check in with some of those middle class manners.
I want to ask you a question about craft, because I'm so impressed that you pulled off sort of the dual timelines, the parallel timelines in this novel. How did you do that? Did you have like plot A spooled out somewhere on a whiteboard and plot B spooled out somewhere on a whiteboard? Or like, how did you keep it all straight?
I started without anything, ridiculously. And then I found myself pretty quickly, I had to draw a diagram. Like an outline wasn't even going to cut it. I had to make a drawing to sort of map it out. And then the drawing was even inadequate. And it still took many drafts and, you know, revision after revision to make it all link up, find the beats, make sure that we're balancing the real world with the imagined world. We're not getting too much of the imagined world, which is much lower stakes because it's not actually happening. Mm. Yes. So diagramming and then just, you know, draft after draft.
Well, you did it. I'm so impressed. It's hard enough to keep one plot straight. I don't know. I can't imagine keeping two. So your day job is as a reporter and editor at Publisher's Lunch, yes?
Yes.
Which that's a publishing industry newsletter. It's a real must read for people in the publishing industry. Can you talk about did your two worlds dovetail? Like as a writer yourself, how does it feel to work for that newsletter? Do you feel encouraged? Do you feel discouraged with what's going on in publishing? Or can you just comment on that a little bit?
It's definitely a little of both. The thing I always say about it is I know too much. You know, like I know what happens to a lot of books and I know how you can succeed and I know how you can fail. And because I cover things, I have to cover awards. I have to cover certain prestigious fellowships. I have to, you know, all of these things that you can win. I know exactly who won. Mm-hmm. So I've become very good at putting up a firewall and learning not to think about that during the actual writing and learning not to compare or like to invoke that knowledge in any way when I'm writing, because it just makes me feel afraid and nervous and doesn't serve the writing in any way.
Yeah.
But then on the bright side, all of that stuff comes in handy in terms of, you know, I know what good book publicity looks like and a good book marketing looks like. And I knew going in when my agent and I were talking about where the book should end up, you know, I knew the names of editors, which I think a lot of writers don't even know unless they go and do, you know, some research first. I just knew offhand who might be a good fit. And we did end up going with one of those people. In fact, my first choice. So it really can serve in that way, as long as I don't let it make me go totally crazy.
Yes. When you sort of got to the stage where you were coming into the marketplace, did your knowledge from your job cause you to do anything different? Did you know which agents you wanted to go to? Did you like change the first chapter because you knew it would catch more eyes or anything like that?
It definitely affected our strategy, I would say. So I already had an agent and we just had a long conversation about how to go about it. And what we decided to do was go out to a very select and directed list because I had all this knowledge at my fingertips over, you know, of who might be a great match. So we made a smaller list. It wasn't such a wide net, you know, it was more focused, and we were able to think of people who actually might genuinely, you know, want to publish it as opposed to just like sending it out to everybody.
Yeah.
So I think that worked really well. And how else did it work? I mean, I think that my agent really helped shape it in terms of bringing it to market, where it's like, she's like, okay, my job isn't necessarily to edit into the final version. It's to make some edits that will make it the most saleable. And part of that was she suggested making the affair larger than it was in the draft that I had sent to her and really delivering on the affair, showing it more than I had been, not shying away from writing that stuff, which as a writer, that's not my favorite stuff to write. Like I don't like love writing the sex scenes, but she's like, you know, if we're going to sell this, you do need to write the sex scenes, like you need to develop them. So that is something that changed right before we went out to editors. And you know, she was ultimately right, as agents usually are.
Yes. I'm afraid we're running out of time. Is there anything that you would like to add about the book that we didn't get to?
I guess I would just like your listeners to know that it, while it deals with some of these topics we've been talking about, it's also funny, juicy, kind of gossipy, you know, sort of. My hope with it was to remind you of people you know. You know, it's like gossip from one town over, you know, people you know or people you almost know, the minor intrigues of their lives. So it's not just zeitgeisty and topical. It's also just plain old juicy.
Yeah, for sure. It was. And like I said in the intro, I really could not put it down. It was so, it's so easy to read and so fun to read and so funny, aside from all the cultural commentary that I found so fascinating. It was just a really fun read. All right. Well, that was Erin Summers, the author of The 10-Year Affair. Erin, thank you so much for joining us on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thank you so much.
Buy the book from Macintosh Books through bookshop.org. We will have links at wgcu.org. Thank you for listening to the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.